You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, good morning. I'd like to welcome you to the event today. We're going to talk about school districts. Presumably, each and every one of you is familiar in some way with a school district, probably having been in one at one point in your life. And so the drill here, the script for this morning, is that we're going to present the results from a study done here in the Brown Center that focuses on questions that have heretofore, I think, been not addressed and answered. And then we're very pleased to be able to have Michelle Rhee here with us to talk to us about her experience with school districts and how it may relate to what we've said in our report. I'm joined on the stage by Matt Chingos, my colleague and one of the co-authors of the study. And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about why we did this study and kind of set it up. And Matt's going to tell you what we found. And if there's anything you don't like about the study, that's all Matt's fault. And anything you like, of course, I will take the credit for. So this, we decided to do this really a couple of years ago. I was trying to remember last night and this morning exactly why we decided to do this, and I can't actually generate the history, except I remember at some point we were talking about school districts, and I tried to find the kind of information that is now readily available on teachers and schools. And that information, which has been contributed by the research community, tells you how much of the variability in student outcomes is, for example, due to teachers in the classroom. And so we've seen a lot of policy ferment in the last few years as we've learned that teachers are really important. And in a corresponding way, we know that that schools are important. They seem to be, based on the data that that are out there, they seem to be less important than teachers, but still important. So I thought that statistical work would have been would have incorporated school districts. And went to look and find what was out there and really couldn't find anything that that looked at the impact of school districts in the same way that the research communities looked at the impact of schools and teachers. The only thing I could find was a little body of literature that has to do with the interesting issue of mayoral control. And so what happens when a school district moves from under the control of a district school board to control of the mayor, and that was mostly case study work. Interesting, but not quite the question we were asking. And so why is this? Particularly given that school districts occupy a really central place in the American educational system. They manage nearly all of the $500 billion a year of public funds, that taxpayer funds that flow to student achievement. They manage the local tax base. They are the recipients of federal funds. They're the recipients of state funds. So if you follow the money, you'd certainly think that districts are terrifically important. They are frequently the operating lever for reform efforts that initiate elsewhere. So as the federal government in particular has moved towards encouraging states to establish a meaningful evaluation teachers systems for teachers, whereby teachers are evaluated based on the achievement gains of their students, it has been districts that have been left with the responsibility of designing these evaluation systems and putting them in place. The most charismatic district leaders over the last decade have gotten a lot of national media attention. Our guest for today, Michelle Rhee, was on the cover of Time magazine with the lead, Michelle Rhee, head of the D.C. Public Schools, could transform public education. So clearly the media thinks that districts and district leaders are important. I played around a little with financial data from New York State. I actually live there, and I know that district superintendents are well paid. So we just checked to see. There's 63 district leaders in New York who received over $300,000 a year in salary and benefits in 2011-2012. Superintendent at the top of the list got a salary and benefits package of $541,000. So compensation is pretty good, I would say. And it's typically, and certainly the case in New York State, lots of district superintendents are paid more than the chief state school officer who's responsible for the whole system of districts. The New York commissioner recently got a raise. It's $212,000 a year, so he's, you know, getting less than half of what the most well-paid district superintendent is getting. You can also follow money in another way and see what the private philanthropies with deep pockets are doing. And some have poured considerable money into district reform, suggesting that they think districts are the lever for reform. The Broad Prize, for example, that will be announced this year in a few days, is a prize given each year. It's $1 million to the district that the Broad Foundation thinks has generated the most improvement. And then finally, you know, if you were trying to justify why it is worth our while to focus on school districts, and you're looking at philanthropies, many of them invest in the opposite direction, suggesting that they think districts are important, but they're important in the sense that they're impediments rather than levers for change. So you see large foundations investing extensively in charter school networks, which, if you will, are the anti-traditional traditional school district. Often, you know, we're so embedded in the education management and organization that that we're familiar with that we don't think about how differently things are organized elsewhere. And so the school district is really a kind of uniquely American institution. It grew up as we grew up, as we had colonies, and first school districts were in Massachusetts, and communities established districts to provide education for the children that they were having and rearing. But if you look elsewhere around the world, you'll find that most of the funding is from state or national sources, whereas most of our funding here remains local funding for schools. You'll see that policies and standards are set nationally. Here, those are set often at the state and district level. And even though you find that some type of local authority is always in place, for example, in Britain, a council that sets priorities and hires principals, most of the actual authority exists at the school building level. So what we have here, where you can go into every large city in America and find a big building somewhere that is the district building, that is full of people doing work for the district, and where that is, you know, if you work in that district as a teacher or principal, you kind of, you're cursing the big building, or you're dealing with the big building, is not something that you necessarily find around the rest of the world. So we've got the premise here that the school districts, at least in America, are very central to the way education is delivered, and are central, at least conceptually, to reform. But we don't know, really, much about their influence on student achievement. So we went into this particular project raising and trying to answer four questions, and we're going to present three of them to you here today. And the first is, how important are school districts relative to the other institutional components? By institutional components, we mean those things that are under the control of the schooling system. And those are teachers, and they are schools. And so if you can imagine for just a little while a pie chart or a pie, you'll get to see an actual one in a little bit. But if you can imagine it, the question is, if we're slicing up the overall differences in student achievement in this pie, what's the size of the slice that represents districts as opposed to the size of the slice that represents schools and the size of the slice that represents teachers? Is it about the same? Is it bigger? Is it smaller? Is it there at all? What is the size of that slice? Again, very surprising to me that no one has previously answered that question. And then if the slice exists, if it's big enough to be detected, is it big enough to be important for education reform? You'll hear later that we're taking a look at results for You know, we've got 5 million observations in our database, so we can detect very small things as statistically significant. So the question is, given that there are differences depending on districts, are the differences big enough to be concerned about? Now, let me try to frame this question in more personal terms. So suppose you have a school-age child, and you're going to shop within a state for the best possible education you can. You're mobile. You can move. Should you be worried about the district? Should that be a decision that's very important to you? And or should you be worried about the school? Or maybe should you just be worried about the classroom that your child is in? So you're shopping around, and we're trying to ask and answer the question, how important is that district decision to you? Can you find good enough schools and good enough teachers almost anywhere? And should that be your decision, or should you care a lot about whether you're living in Arlington or Washington, D.C., when it comes to the potential for educating your child? And if we find that the district slice is big enough to care about, then our third question is, are there districts that show exceptional patterns of performance over time? Now, much of the theory around school districts as levers of reform is that there are, for example, consistently bad ones. And if we could just get a new set of legislation and a new leader, well, those bad ones could get a lot better. Is that true? Do we find that there are districts that are consistently good, that beat their own demographics in terms of their performance of children? And do we find districts that are climbers and districts that are experience something that looks like a nosedive? If we could identify those kind of interesting patterns over a considerable period of time, it would, we think, be exciting if you're interested in trying to find out why some districts work and why some districts don't. On the other hand, if we found, well, in a particular year, there's some good districts and some bad districts, but they're different the next year, there's no consistent pattern to performance, then it's a very different message for school reform. So those are the three questions we hope to answer for you today. And so in a subsequent event, we're going to try to tell you why some districts might be better than others, but we actually don't know the answer to that yet, so we can't share it with you, even if you force us to. So with that as an introduction, I'd like to again introduce you to Matt Chinkos, a fellow here in the Brown Center, and Matt's also our director of research, and so it falls to him to present to you the findings. This is always the toughest job, because when you get around to findings like this, it's somewhat like reading, you know, the deed to your home. There's a lot of technical stuff in there, which isn't easy to present to a general audience. But if anybody can do it, Matt can. So, Matt, please take my place here.
Thanks, Russ. So I brought the deed here to read. So I'm going to start off talking a little bit about the methodology and data underlying this study before I jump into the results. And I think the start of the methodology section is a good point to acknowledge the work of our colleague Mike Gallagher, who's a co-author on the report and did a lot of the writing of the deed or generating the numbers underlying the deed. Maybe we're stretching this metaphor a little too far. So the methodology underlying the report is something called hierarchical linear modeling, or HLM. And basically what it does is a statistical routine that allows us to divide up student test scores into the pie that Russ referenced. And when he promised you a real pie, he meant a figure. I immediately thought, oh, we're getting a pie. But there's no real pie. Where each slice represents the relative contribution of these different levels in the education system. Of districts, which is what we're mainly interested in today, schools within those districts, classrooms within those schools, and then students within those classrooms. So it tells us how much does student achievement vary across districts, and then within each district, you know, on average, how much does student achievement vary across schools within the district, how much does it vary across classrooms within the school, and how much does it vary across students within the same classroom. So the key thing here is what this pie is going to tell us is how much these differences matter. So an important caveat to the results is that if we did something that improved all schools or all districts or all teachers, that wouldn't show up here. We're looking at sort of current variation in policy and practice that lead to these differences we observe in the data. Now, as you all know, people don't just, you know, randomly show up at a school or district. They shop around the state, shop around schools within a district. Maybe they even put in a request for a particular teacher. So because these student populations are different, we take into account a rich set of student demographic information that we observe in the data, things like free lunch status as an indicator for socioeconomic status, race and ethnicity, the age of the student, and so on. So what these controls allow us to assess is how well a given district performs in terms of the achievement and math and reading tests of their students, not just compared to any other district, but compared to districts with similar populations of students. Now, the data that we use for this study are student-level longitudinal databases from the states of Florida and North Carolina. So this is basically every kid in public schools in those states who took the state assessments at the end of the year in math and reading. We focus on grades 4 and 5 because we have, you know, test scores at the ends of those grades. And those are the grades where students still have a single classroom teacher. So once we get into the middle school grades, it gets a little more difficult to disentangle the district, the school, and the classroom, because now there's not just one primary classroom, but there are a number of classrooms depending on the subject being taught. So, you know, Russ mentioned we have tons and tons of observations. We have about 500,000 observations of students per year over 10 years. In order to show you the most recent results, and because we have so much data for each year, we're going to focus primarily on results from the 2009-10 school year, which is the most recent year in our data. But then later on, when we look at these patterns of exceptional districts, I'll show you some differences over time in district performance. And I think it's worth noting this is the kind of research that was impossible to do a decade ago because, A, you know, most states didn't have these kinds of longitudinal databases that are now pretty common in this country. And we just didn't have the computing power to take, 500,000 observations, even just, 1 year of data, and churn it through one of these HLM models in order to partition the variation and even just something simple like the pie chart that I'm going to show you now. So this is our first research question. Oh, it wants to restart.
Oh, no.
Later. All right. Oh, don't forget to tweet. Did anyone remind you to tweet? So this is the pie chart. So if you look at this, I know. These figures are all in the report. These are the figures from the report. All right. So if folks want to call out the page numbers, that'd be fine. I believe this is figure one in the report.
Page 9.
I'll tell you the important numbers here. So if you can't see the figure, I'll tell you what you need to know. So the key things here, if you look at these institutional levels, the school, the district, and the classroom, you see 1% of the variation is at the district level, the one that we're here to talk about today. 2%, about twice that, is at the school level. And then 7%, seven times the district number, is at the teacher level. So that leaves 90% to be accounted for by the control variables, which is, age, free lunch, race, ethnicity, stuff like that. And then another 59%, which is left unexplained. And by unexplained, we mean that's variation at the student level, just, different kids having different levels of achievement. That's measurement error. These tests aren't perfect. That's the dog barking outside the classroom on the day of the test. So does this mean, you can take a look at this, you might say, well, it looks like the answer to the title of your report, do districts matter, is no. It's only 1%. I guess we can sort of pack it up and go home early because we don't need to answer the rest of our research questions. But if we interpreted the results that way, we might also say, look, the teacher slice is only 7%. Looks like teachers don't matter either. But, I think most of the folks in the room know, based on lots of research from at least the last decade and going back further, that there are huge differences in student outcomes from being assigned to a highly effective teacher versus a less effective teacher. So we can take those numbers, take that, if we took the 7% of the teachers, and we put that into a sort of a standard deviation. What's the difference between a teacher at the 30th percentile and the 70th percentile? In our data, we tell you it's, 0.16 standard deviations, and here 10% of a standard deviation is about a quarter of a year of learning, so that's something like a third of a year of learning, from having a teacher at the 70th percentile versus the 30th percentile. Now, let's do the same thing with the districts. Let's take that, 1% slice of the pie and see what that translates into. And what you see here, it's the 0.11. And once again, 0.1 is about a quarter of a year. So basically, you move from a 30th percentile district, sort of slightly below average district, to 70th percentile, which is above average district. And you get about a quarter of a year learning more by the end of a fourth and fifth grade. So we think that's pretty meaningful. And that the because those 1, 2, and 7% numbers, you know, are just sort of a small slice of the sort of policy variation in our data, that once you look within that, you see these meaningful differences. So what we can also do is we can take the estimates from our HLM model and calculate them for every district in Florida and North Carolina using the 2009-10 data in this case, and then plot them. Now, of course, in a given year, you observe, you know, the group of fourth and fifth graders in the district that year. Some of these districts in Florida and North Carolina, small rural districts, so you don't get a perfect estimate. So what we show you here, what's called a 95% confidence interval, and it just gives you some sense of both our best guess for the estimate and then, you know, kind of how uncertain we are. So if it's a district with a very small number of kids, it's going to be a wide bar because maybe, you know, we just got a weird group of kids that year. If it's a huge urban school district, it's going to be a much more precise estimate because it's that many more students. So what you can see, this is the figure for North Carolina, is that there's a lot of, you know, zero is the average. So there's plenty of districts that are kind of around the average, which is the sort of finding that, you know, there's not a huge amount of variation in student achievement across districts. But then what you see kind of at the far right and the far left is pretty big differences. So if you just looked at above average and below average by a statistically significant margin in this 1 year of data, in Florida you'd find that 10% of districts are above average and 7% are below average. And if you did the same thing, well, that was Florida, and if you did the same thing in North Carolina, you'd find 10% above average and 14% above average. And you'd also see big differences between the highest and lowest performing districts. So if you compared the top performing district in North Carolina with the bottom performing district, you get 0.42 standard deviations. And before I told you that 0.1 standard deviation is about a quarter of a year, that's basically a whole year. Students in the best district in North Carolina, by the end of fourth and fifth grade, have learned a whole year's worth more than students in the worst performing district. And in Florida, the difference between the top and the bottom is about 0.3 standard deviation, so a little bit less, but still pretty big. So what this shows you is that the overall, you know, I mentioned the overall variation in district effects is, you know, we think large enough to be relevant for policy, perhaps modest compared to some of the other factors, but that there are these huge differences at the extreme. So this leads us to the third research question that Russ identified, which is, are there exceptional districts that not just in 1 year of data in 2009-10 did well or did poorly, did average, but are there exceptional districts that consistently, you know, over multiple years performed very well or consistently performed very poorly or made a transformative growth or saw precipitous declines? And we find examples of states, of districts, that fall into all four of those categories, despite appearing to serve roughly similar student populations in both of the states that we look at. So here's four districts in North Carolina. So you see one district here that consistently performed at or above the 70th percentile, you know, so better than 70% of all districts, you know, every year for an entire decade, from 2000, 2001, 2009, 2010. You see another district here that basically hovered around the 10th percentile of the district performance every year. And once again, these are taking into account those factors I mentioned earlier, you know, adjusting for the fact that students serve different student populations. And then you see, you know, one district that grew from beneath the 30th percentile at the beginning of the decade and was about the 65th percentile by the end of the decade. And then a fourth district that the opposite finding. They, for the first 5 years of the data, were in the top 10% of districts, and then within 3 years fell to the bottom 10%. And if you switch to the Florida data, you see similar examples. You know, high-flying districts, very poorly performing district, districts that made growth, districts that saw declines. So I think these patterns clearly cry out for explanation. You know, are there, this is the fourth research question that Russ recommend identified, are there policies and practices that separate these high-performing from low-performing districts? You know, what explains, you know, this huge decline in Collier County? What explains the huge growth in Orange County, Florida? So you'll have to wait for our next report to find out what the Florida and North Carolina data reveal. But we think that the case for the importance of districts is strong enough now for education researchers and reformers to also start trying to answer some of these questions for themselves.
So you've taken your medicine, and now comes the dessert. Before I introduce Michelle, I was at another meeting this morning, and I was previewing for someone who'd been a chief state school officer in one of the states in question, the example districts that are in the report. And he picked the worst performing one. Before I mentioned the names, he said, is District X in your data? I said, yes. He said, oh, that was the thorn in my side the whole time I was there. I said, so we don't know yet why this is a bad performing district. What do you think? And he had very strong intuitions about it. He said, if you look at the way they've organized their schools, they've managed to maintain segregated schools. They've got a couple of magnet schools that attract and retain the middle-class white kids in town, and everybody else is served in really high-minority schools that don't have good teachers. So I really felt good about that because it suggests that we're not dealing just with patterns of data, but there are reasons underlying those patterns of data that, again, I think are important for us to understand. So to shift not topics, but sections of the program, it really isn't necessary to introduce Michelle Rhee in this town. In some sense, she goes, everybody knows her, but it is my pleasure to introduce her anyhow. So, in some sense, Michelle is a prototype of one version of the American dream. She is the child of immigrants. She's done extraordinarily well. Just a little bit of her background. She was born in Ann Arbor, raised in Toledo, got her BA in government from Cornell University. Sometime later, picked up a master's in public policy from the Kennedy School at Harvard. She was a Teach for America teacher in Baltimore. After that, founded and ran for 10 years the New Teacher Project, now TNTP, that does a number of things, but its primary responsibility has been to provide a non-traditional route into teaching for highly qualified people in urban schools. I wasn't able to actually find out the numbers that correspond exactly with Michelle's tenure, but I'm going to guess probably while you were there, roughly 20,000 teachers were attracted into urban public schools, New York City, for example, through the New Teacher Project. She served from 2007 to 2010 as chancellor of the D.C. Public Schools. Got a lot of coverage during that time for an amazingly audacious, in the context of what had come before, reform agenda. We've heard a lot about teacher evaluation and compensation systems, but Michelle also did a lot of just organizational change in the D.C. system in terms of closing schools, changing managers, trying to get a competent management system in place. I spent a little time yesterday just checking NAEP scores for the District of Columbia. During her tenure, NAEP, actually, the assessment points are pretty closely correspond to Michelle's tenure here. There was, for example, NAEP scores in math at fourth grade were up 8 points in the District of Columbia from 2007 to 2011 versus a 1-point increase for the nation. So there was real progress in the district. When she left the D.C. public schools. She was telling me earlier this morning it came as a shock to her that she would be doing that. But when she left the D.C. public schools, she went on to found and run Students First. It has roughly a million members, substantial financial backing, and it advocates for reform policies that she thinks would have helped her do her job had those policies been in place and would help other districts do their job. things like meaningful teacher evaluation, parent triggers, policies that give district leaders more authority to do the jobs that they are held accountable for doing. So with that as introduction, again, I want to take great pleasure in having Michelle here with us. I think it's the first open public meeting she's talked at since she was here as D.C. Chancellor, so it's a great opportunity to hear what she has to say, both reflections on the work that she's doing and reflections on the importance of school districts. So, Michelle Reed.
So, I was extremely curious when I saw the report cover, Do Districts Matter? And when I opened it and sort of read the executive summary, you know, it said, more research needs to be done. But we kind of think so. And my answer to this is absolutely. And it's not just about the 1% sliver of the pie. I would actually argue that it's much more than that. And I'm going to talk about sort of three different things. Let me just give you a little background in saying that I am not a statistician. I'm not a fancy academic. So I'm not going to be talking about hierarchical linear models. I'm going to tell you three quick stories and sort of describe to you how those stories correlate to why districts do make a huge difference in the equation. So here's the first story. When I was the chancellor in D.C., when I got here, I made it a priority, and I actually committed to myself that I was going to be out in schools as much as I possibly could. After the first few weeks of doing this, I realized that I needed to change up my strategy, because every time I would show up at a school, you know, I would, you know, the folks in the district office would arrange these visits for me, and I'd pull up to the parking lot, and I would be greeted by the marching band and the dance squad, you know, a big pep rally, and that is not what I wanted to see. So I started doing unannounced visits, because I didn't want to see the dog and pony show. I wanted to go into classrooms and see what was going on every single day in the schools. So I remember one day very early on in my tenure, pulled up to a school that is in Trinidad, as you know, one of the most downtrodden parts of the city, high crime rates, et cetera, and pulled up to this school. Across the street from the school was a liquor store and a nightclub. As I was walking up the front walk, it was strewn with broken beer bottles, cigarette butts, and syringes. So it was the picture of urban blight. And I walked into this school, just chose a hallway to walk down, and then, you know, chose one random classroom to walk in. And what I saw was absolutely amazing. So there was a teacher who was bounding around the classroom, full of energy, excited. 30 kids who were all focused, transfixed on this teacher, could not have cared less that I walked into the room. So I'm looking around, I'm watching the class sort of interact, and I could tell by sort of watching what was going on that they were learning a unit about Greek mythology. And they were reading a chapter book. And the book was about a group of kids who had traveled back in time, back to the time of Greek gods. And they were at the part of the story where they had to go back home. They were done with their adventure. So the teacher says to the children, okay, please look up at the posters on the walls. And she had created a number of posters. Each one was of a different Greek god and what they were the god of. And she said, and tell me, if you were one of these kids, and you could only call on one god to help you travel back to time, which god would it be and why? So I look up at all the posters. You know, I've got my answer. The first kid raises his hand. He said, I would choose Zeus, because Zeus is the god of gods. He's the boss of everybody else. If he tells you to do something, you have to do it. So I figure just cut out the middleman and go straight to the big guy. It's like, that was a very good answer, right? Second kid raises her hand. She said, I would choose this god. It was the god of women, children, and families. She said, these are kids we're talking about. She's the god of children. These are her peeps. She's got to take care of them. So I would choose her. This is another good answer. Third kid raises his hand. He said, I would choose this god. It was the god of art, music, and literature. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, kid, that was a total misfire, right? Then the kid goes on to explain. He says, as you'll remember from the story, the way the kids got transported back in time is that they dug up an old Greek lyre, and they strummed the strings of the lyres, and that's how they traveled back in time. He said, so I figure if they have to go back home, it has something to do with the lyre, so that they should call on the god of music. And I said, huh, that was really good. These kids came up with five or six unbelievably innovative, creative answers before somebody came up with my ever-lame answer of the god of travel. And I thought, this is exactly what you want to see in a classroom. Every single one of these children was 100% engaged. They were using their critical thinking and analytical skills. The teacher was sort of facilitating a very high-quality conversation. You could tell that this was, just very, very good instruction, and the kids were getting a lot out of it. So I was thrilled. I walk out of that classroom, and I walk into the classroom directly across the hall to the exactly opposite situation. So I walk into this classroom, and I nearly run into the teacher as I open the door because she's standing in the door jamb. And she's saying, she's screaming at the kids. She's saying, everybody, be quiet! She said, I have been telling you all morning to shut up and nobody is listening to me. I don't understand what's wrong with you. So I am going to count down from 10. And by the time I get to 1, I want everyone's mouths closed. So then she starts counting down. 10, 9, 8. And she starts flicking the light switch on and off. 7, flick, flick, flick. 6, flick, flick. 5. Then she says, I'm waiting. And you're looking at the kids. They're like, we're waiting too for something to happen. I was in each of these classrooms for no longer than 10 to 15 minutes apiece. And I can tell you without a doubt that these two groups of children, both of whom came from the same disadvantaged community, who were walking into the same dilapidated school building every day, where there was rainwater leaking through the roofs and ceiling tiles falling on their heads, were getting two wildly different educational experiences because of the adults who were in front of them every day. Teachers matter. The data showed that, right? About 7% of the pie is based on teachers. But what I would argue is that the district is responsible for determining which teachers stay in the classrooms and which go. It's the district that is collectively bargaining to say, it's okay in a time of layoffs that we're laying teachers off strictly based on seniority and not quality, because that is going to impact whether the Greek god teacher gets to stay or the light switcher is staying based on that policy that the district is governing. The teacher evaluation systems that we are developing every day, to Russ's point, are being developed by the school district. If the school district is developing and implementing an evaluation tool that essentially says everybody is great, which is what we used to have in D.C., 98% of the teachers were being rated as doing an excellent job when only 8% of the kids in the system were operating on grade level in mathematics at the 8th grade. That is the school system that is determining the quality, who is in the classroom every day, and the quality of that instruction in many ways. And so I would argue that it's not just the 1%, but it also encompasses the 6.8 and the other 1.4% that is encompassed in the school and teacher category that is also controlled by the district. And therefore, what the district does actually makes up about 10% of that pie. So that's the first story. The second thing, and then my second and third stories are a little bit more maybe devoid from the data, but I think absolutely make a difference. So my second story is about children. And children are oftentimes forgotten in all of these policy debates. We rarely talk about kids and their perceptions of things, but it absolutely matters. So in my second year on the job, By that time, I had gained what my husband would call an unfortunate reputation of answering every email and answering it very quickly. And I would tell parents and kids and teachers all the time, if you have a question, if you need anything, email me directly. And so people started taking me up on it. And I remember one evening getting an email from a student who said, hello, Chancellor Rhee. My name is Valencio. I am a eighth grade student at Shaw at Garnet Patterson Middle School, and I would like to request a meeting with you. So it was my policy never to turn down a meeting with a kid. So I forwarded that email onto my scheduler, and I sort of forgot about it. And then a few weeks later, I'm, running around from meeting to meeting. It's the end of the day. As I'm walking into the conference room, I don't know what meeting I'm going into. My staff hands me a folder, and I open the door, and I'm sort of stopped in my tracks. Because around my conference room, there are 10 13-year-old boys, all dressed in scruffy little suits and ties. They all have manila folders in front of them, looking ridiculously serious. So I come down and I sit down and I say, "Hi, boys, how are you? What can I help you with?" And the kid who sent me the email said, "Well, I'm the one that sent you the email and requested the meeting, and we are here to lobby you." And I said, "Okay, what do you want from me?" And he said, "Well, as you know, this was our first year in the combined Shaw Edgar Garnett Patterson Middle School. And just as a little bit of background, this was one of the schools, Shaw was one of the middle schools that we closed during the difficult school closure process. We merged it with another school. And we were, quite frankly, very worried because these were two low-performing middle schools that were very, very troubled. And one troubled middle school is bad enough. You think about combining two of them, and it's enough to sort of keep you up at night. What would happen? So we merged those two schools together. We brought in a brand new principal into our system who was an administrator out in Montgomery County, somebody who I thought had tremendous potential to turn a school around. And so this was the situation that we were facing. So this little boy says, "Well, we are here to lobby you, because we would like to stay here for the ninth grade instead of going on to high school." Now, if any of you know any middle schoolers or have been in a middle school, you know that that is not a sentiment that middle school kids have. Middle school kids can't wait to get out of middle school and go on to high school and be big kids, etc. So I'm thinking to myself, what's going on? And another young man says, "Well, let me just give you our perspective." He said, "From my vantage point, I can tell you that this is the first time since I have been in kindergarten in the DC public schools where I feel like I'm getting a high quality education. This principal cares about us. The teachers in this school are amazing. They're both honest with us, but they challenge us as well. So they've told us that we're really far behind where we're supposed to be. But they also tell us that we can all go to college if we want to. And so they help us work towards catching up and attaining that goal." They said, "So here's the thing. We've had a great year. We have wonderful teachers. We're starting to catch up academically and all these things. But we're worried because if we only have 1 year of this kind of experience under our belt, we're afraid that if we go off to high school, we're going to get caught up in the wrong crowds, doing the wrong kinds of things, and we're going to lose everything." He said, "If you would let us stay here for another year, and we'd have two foundational years under our belt, then we think that we could withstand all the craziness of high school and be successful in the long run." Last thing this young man said was, he's a kind of a bigger kid. And I was like, "Really? You're in eighth grade?" He looked like a grown man. And he said, "I can tell you that I used to go to Shaw. And if you ask anybody who went to Shaw last year, anyone who worked there, they would tell you that I was one of the biggest troublemakers there was." He said, "I was starting fights all the time. I got suspended. I almost got expelled. I was a mess." He said, "Now, I believe I'm the model student." He said, "I wake up every morning and I can't wait to come to school. That's what this group of adults has created for us." So I'm thinking to myself, okay, guys, if you stay in middle school and you don't go to high school, you can't take the same kinds of courses. You don't have access to the same kinds of facilities. You can't play high school sports. The kids all look at me and they're like, we're good. It's fascinating. So I leave that meeting and I'm so intrigued by the conversation. And I go into a meeting with my senior staff and I say to them, you're not going to believe this meeting that I just had with this group of kids. I said, 13-year-old boys who are telling me that they are excited every morning to wake up and come to school because of the environment that has been created. They want to stay there for another year. So I'm trying to figure out, can we make that happen? My staff looks at me, they start shaking their heads. And then they come up with about 50 different reasons why we cannot do that. Well, the Carnegie units of how we give kids credits don't match from middle school to high school, the certification levels of the teachers and then the textbooks. So, to me it just sounds like wah, 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 Charlie Brown kind of stuff. So they finish their list of 50 things. And I look around the room and I say, just tell me this. Can you guarantee me that if we don't let these kids stay, we can find high school placements for all of them? Well, that will guarantee that they will get a higher quality experience in that high school than they would if we let them stay in the middle school. Dead silence. I said, if we can't, then we're going to do it. Grumbles all around, right? Don't make the decision too quickly. Please let us bring you some data. I said, that's fine. So I put off the decision for a while. One of my staff members comes in a few weeks later and says, you know, we're doing the school budgeting process. We've got to know what you're thinking on this thing. We need a decision. So before I made any final decisions, I decided I was going to go out to the school. So I go to the school one day, again, unannounced. Nobody knows I'm coming. Walk into the building, and the hallways are clear. There is no turmoil, there's no, there's no fighting going on, et cetera, et cetera. I'm walking into classroom after classroom after classroom, every single one of them. You've got students engaged, focused, great teaching going on. It was truly a sight to see. So I walk into my last classroom, and I'm sitting in the corner while the class is going on. And over on the opposite corner, I see a group of four boys. And they're whispering to each other, and they're handing something to each other under the table. And I was like, ha, now this is what I expected to see, right? So I'm like, busted. So I walk over to the kids, and I say, excuse me, young man, let me see what you're passing around. And I'm expecting, anything from an iPod to, drugs or something like that. What could it be? Something bad, right? The boy, is holding the thing, sheepishly looks up at me, and he has this crumpled up Washington Post article where he has highlighted in yellow highlighter his favorite parts of the article, and he's passing it around so the other table mates can read it, and they're all reading it and they're talking about it. And I said, is this what doing the wrong thing looks like in this school right now? And I left the school thinking, done. We're going to do this. The kids came back a little while later. Thank you so much for letting us stay here. And I said, you have to make me one guarantee that you are not going to be back here next year asking me to have a 10th grade here at the middle school. They said, no, we promise. But what it did for the children in this school was make them, one, believe in the district. They actually believed that if they voiced their opinion, if they made a compelling case for something involving their education, that somebody would listen to them and make a decision that was not in the best interest of what was easiest for the district, but was in the best interest of them. That made them more invested and engaged in their education. They were out to prove to me that next year that they were going to just knock it out of the park, that you were going to see the scores in that district and that school rise, that you were going to see everything, every measure of improvement move up because they had been driving the decision-making about what should happen in that school. And I don't think that you can underestimate that piece of it, how kids are feeling, whether we're engaging them, whether they feel listened to. So that's the second story. And then the third quick story. And many of you may have already heard this one, but I think it bears worth repeating. When I first got to the district, one of the most disheartening things or the most compelling pieces of data was about our expenditures. We were spending more money per child than almost any jurisdiction in the country, according to lots of different sources. And yet the results, the student achievement levels, were at the absolute bottom. So we were a case study for why more expenditures don't always necessarily result in better outcomes. And when I got here and I was trying to figure out what do you do to fix the most dysfunctional school district in the country, a lot of people said to me, you have to figure out where all the money is going, right? Why are we spending all this money and yet our schools look like they do? Because when you went into the schools, you would never guess that we were one of the richest school districts in the nation. Teachers were having to buy supplies out of their own pocketbook. There were, you know, the buildings were falling apart. We did not have the kinds of environments that were conducive to kids learning. So where was all this money going? So I thought this was as good a place as any to start. I sent my folks out, said, figure out where all the money's going. 2 weeks later, a special assistant of mine came back, and he said, okay, I did what you said. I looked at all the spreadsheets, all the bottom lines, and what I found was really interesting. And so I'm going to share two very interesting data points with you. So for those of you who know anything about school districts, interesting is a euphemism for whack. So I knew I was in for something good. So he says, the first thing I found is that we are spending nearly $80 million a year transporting a few thousand special education kids through the system. So I did the quick back of the envelope math, and it turned out that it was about, you know, $9,000 per kid per year just on transportation. So I thought, you know, this is a little crazy, right? You could, for that amount of money a year, you could buy the kid a Saturn the first year, a car, and a driver for that car every year after that. I said, I don't know anything about organizing bus routes, but I know that I can do it for cheaper than that. So this is good news, because now we're going to make the bus system more efficient, and we are going to take the savings and put it into the classroom. And he said, not so fast. See, the district had done such a poor job of transporting kids in the past that now we were under a court order, a consent decree. And there was a court-appointed special master who was responsible for running the transportation system. And he said, so now all we are allowed to do is pay the bill at the end of the year. We have no ability to control the costs. And I said, that is the craziest thing I have ever heard. And he looked at me and he said, that's because you haven't heard the second thing that I came here to tell you. He said, I'm trying to figure out where all the kids are going. He said, the district is only a few miles, square miles, you know, high and long. The buses could be doing laps around the city all day, and I still don't know how you burn enough gas to cost that much money per year. He said, so I'm looking into this, and I'm figuring out that not only had the district done a poor job of transporting kids, it had also done a poor job of educating kids. And because of that, the parents felt their only outlet was to sue the school district. They would usually win because they were right. The district had not done what they were supposed to do. And it resulted in the courts ordering for those children to be sent to a private school, and the district had to pay the tuition to those schools. I had never heard of anything like that before. And what my assistant told me was, it's not just any school. It's not just we can determine the school. We don't determine the school. So these kids are going to all these far-flung places. You have kids going to Baltimore. You kids have kids going to Virginia every day. And so essentially what happens is, if in a particular housing complex, you have 10 special education kids who live there, in the morning, 10 buses line up with 10 different bus drivers and 10 different bus matrons, all heading in different places where they could drive between an hour and a half and 2 hours one way, and then on the way back. This is why it's costing us so much money. So I said, okay, this is all just a little crazy. I don't even understand. Well, we have to pay private school tuition. So I need to dig into this. And he said, well, let me just give you a quick example. He said, I tracked down one particular mid-level bureaucrat in the district. She, in 1 week, made two mistakes. With one kid, she didn't fill out a form she was supposed to fill out. And with another kid, she didn't have a meeting she was supposed to have. And in both of these cases, it resulted in these kids getting sent to a private facility that cost this district $227,000 a year in tuition. I said, okay, I'm going to have to meet this lady. So my assistant calls the lady, says, ma'am, we need you to come to a meeting at the chancellor's office tomorrow at 5 o'clock. The lady says, well, I'm going to have to check with my supervisor on that. My assistant says, ma'am, the chancellor is your supervisor. She's everybody's supervisor. She's like, all right, well, I'll come, but I'm going to bring my lawyer with me. He says, bring whoever you have to bring, just show up at 5 o'clock. So the next day rolls around. I walk into the meeting with her. I said, so I understand you have a question about whether or not you should come to this meeting. He said, no. I just got a little freaked out. I'm okay now. I'm here. I said, great. I said, I have two questions. I said, this kid, you didn't fill out the form. This kid, you didn't have the meeting. I said, help me understand how that happened. She looks at me and she says, well, you need to understand that I am a very busy person. I have lots of kids in my caseload. I have lots of meetings to attend every day. Things are going to fall through the cracks. That's just the way it is. And I looked at her and I said, no, you need to understand that if you believe this job is too big for you, then you need to go find another job. I said, however, if you are going to take the paycheck home every other week, then you have to take personal responsibility for doing everything within your job purview and doing it extraordinarily well. And she looks at me and she said, but that's not fair. I heard that sentiment over and over and over again as I traveled through the central office and into the infamous warehouse, which you, if you were here at the time, you knew that we went to the warehouse and suddenly found all these books and computers and supplies that had been delivered to the district but that had never been delivered out to the schools. When you have this kind of dynamic going on, you lose the faith and confidence of the public. Who wants to send their kid to a public school where they can't get a phone call answered, where the air conditioning is not working for the fifth day in a row? As the district, we have the obligation to run the system in such a way that builds faith and confidence amongst the public. If you don't do that, then enrollment will decrease, then the dollars will decrease, and the likelihood that the district can ever recover becomes harder and harder. So when you have a culture that is absolutely devoid of accountability, and when you have a dynamic where the public just doesn't have any confidence in what you're doing every day, that has a detrimental impact on not just how the district overall operates, but how the city operates in general. So my point with all those three stories is that the district absolutely matters. And I would argue that you shouldn't just look at the district in the 30th percentile versus the district in the 70th percentile, but you should look at the first percentile versus the 100th. This is what is possible. And even if you are here, because you know that these people are operating under a lot of the same constraints and bureaucracy, et cetera, this is what we should aspire to. And when we know that in many of these states, the differential with the same group of kids can be up to a year's worth of learning in 1 year, think about what that means over the lifetime of a kid's public education career. You are talking about the ability for a high-performing district to change the life chances and life outcomes of a kid. So does that matter? Do districts matter? My contention would be absolutely. Thank you.
Well, that was wonderful. I mentioned in my introduction that there had been charismatic district superintendents over the last decade, so Michelle is certainly highest, perhaps, or certainly high in that category. Just a couple of questions before we let the audience have a chance to interact with you. I mean, what you're doing now with Students First is advocating largely at the state legislature level. One of the things about a school reform agenda that depends on charismatic, incredibly skillful and forceful people is that they are always in short supply. Yep. And so what is it? Are there things in terms of state legislation, federal legislation, that prevent or make it very difficult for districts with average leaders that are down at the 10th or 15th percentile to move up? What would you like to see change that would make it easier for everybody, including would have made it easier for you when you were here, but would also help the average sure. district superintendent?
So what I would say is that educators in general, not all educators, but sort of as a group, whether you're talking about teachers or principals, district administrators, are a pretty risk-averse group. So they're not trying to, you know, try different new innovative things. And I'll give you an example. When I got done having that conversation with the woman who, with those two mistakes, cost me $500,000, I wanted to fire her. And my general counsel said, well, you can't fire people. I mean, that's not how things work here. We have, you know, there's a system and a process. And there's only two ways you can fire people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And sort of after a while of doing this, and his point was, if we terminate this person, we run the risk of litigation. And my point was, I am okay running the risk of litigation because I can go into any courtroom and argue why having this person as part of the system is a detriment to what we do every day, or why having an ineffective teacher in the classroom, you know, is almost criminal in terms of what's happening to kids. So I will go into court and argue that point. But we are not going to keep these folks in the classroom doing a disservice to kids every day simply because we are scared of what might happen if there is litigation. And so if you're risk-averse, then you're just going to say, oh, we got to keep them, right? And I think that's sort of part of the dilemma that we have. Are there laws, policies, and rules in place that constrain most superintendents? Absolutely. I mean, when you hear from your general counsel, well, we can't do that, or we're not supposed to X, Y, and Z, then, you know, you sort of roll your eyes in the back of your head and kind of hope for the best, right? But if we were able to lift or change those things, if we were able to create a teacher evaluation system that said, of course, if somebody is ineffective, then, you know, we'll try to provide them with the professional development that they need. But if they don't improve very quickly, then we can remove them from the system pretty efficiently. That frees up people who don't have to be super innovative, super risk-taking people to be able to do the things that they know are right. And what our contention at Students First is that there is no shortage of really high-quality educators, teachers, principals, et cetera, in this country. There's no shortage of them. The problem is not the kids. The problem is not the teachers. The problem is that the kids and teachers and principals are forced to operate in this incredibly antiquated bureaucracy that is driven by these rules that make absolutely no sense whatsoever when it comes to, you know, raising student achievement levels. And so what we need to do is fix the laws and policies. Now, we put the right laws and policies in place. That's not a silver bullet. That's not going to mean that everything automatically gets better. But what it does mean is that then the effective educators that are out there are going to be able to take advantage of those things and chart a different path for what's possible.
One of the things that's interesting about the district is the vibrant charter sector, which last I looked was 42-45% of student enrollment. What role did that play in first the Finty re effort to reform the D.C. public schools? And what role do you think it plays in a broader context in terms of providing choices for parents or providing, again, a competitive force for reform?
Yeah. So I'd say a few things. One, I believe that we have to create a dynamic in this country where no family ever feels like their kid is trapped in a failing school. We always have to have a few high-quality options for every parent to choose from to determine what is in the best interests of their kid. And charter schools can help us do that. So I'm a huge fan of effective charter schools, and while I was here, I tried to do everything I possibly could to help the high-performing charter schools grow to scale. But I will also say that I don't think that charter schools in and of themselves are the answer. Because while we have lots of really high performing and great charter schools in this city and in this country, we also have a whole lot of crappy ones. And so the idea that somehow let's charter every school and then all of our problems are solved is absolutely incorrect. You still need the kinds of laws that say, if you are a low performing charter school, we are going to close you down just as aggressively, if not more aggressively, than we would close down a low performing traditional public school. And that essentially in most states is not happening right now, that level of accountability. And so that's why I am not one who would say, oh yes, charter schools are the end all be all. I think they're part of the answer, but one piece of a broader puzzle. Here in D.C., I would say that the charter sector, and in particular because the charter laws here are so friendly and they facilitate high-quality charters from being able to come to the city and able to grow to scale, because the charters had gained such a significant market share, it helped our efforts significantly. Because, you know, by the time I got here, it was about 33% of kids in the city who were in charter schools. So even the people who liked the status quo and didn't want anything to change, they were looking up and saying, oh my gosh, if we don't do something soon to the district, pretty soon we're not going to have a District of Columbia Public Schools anymore. It's all going to be charter schools. And so there was absolutely a burning platform and a belief that we had to reform the traditional public schools because something was happening. Whether you looked at it from one side of the equation or the other, everyone sort of was in agreement that the reform, aggressive reform, needed to happen. Now, what that reform looked like was a different story, but everyone at the outset was on board, yes, we need change. So I think that was an important lever, because if a school district, you look at the states where there are no charter schools, there are no options for parents, et cetera, there's not a lot of, those are not the hotbeds of innovation, right? If you are a low-performing school district and you are guaranteed that those kids are going to come to you day in and day out, whether or not you provide high-quality services to them, there's no incentive, really, to innovate and change aggressively. We had that incentive here because of the charter sector, and I think the charter sector in general can provide that kind of heat, for lack of a better word, to push the broader districts to be more aggressive in their efforts.
It's a question I probably shouldn't ask you, but I can't not ask it. What would you do differently if you were starting again in the district?
So here's the bottom line. I made mistakes every day in the district. I mean, I would be the last person to tell you that we were perfect. We were far from it. But what I am very confident about is the fact that the decisions that we made, the policy decisions that we made and what we wanted to put in place, were absolutely the right policies. I'm 100% clear on that. What I know now in hindsight is that how you do things is just as important as what you do. And that's where we fell short. And quite frankly, a lot of that was out of naivete. I came into this thinking, I run the school district. My job is to manage the schools every day and meet with the principals and the kids and the teachers. And what I had no clue about was the fact that this was essentially, it was a campaign in the broader public. I wasn't thinking about and concerned about creating a narrative and sending a message about what we were doing. I very stupidly thought that I was taking certain actions and it would be obvious to everybody why I was doing those things. But I didn't communicate that particularly well. The people who didn't like what I was doing, they had a very clear narrative. They had very clear messages, and they pushed those out relentlessly. And because I wasn't saying anything on my side, that narrative sort of stuck and became the reality. And then it fed into a lot of the different mistakes that we made along the way, et cetera. So, I would say, I don't know if I would do anything differently, because life is about, I think, learning all of your lessons that you need to learn along the way. But if I were to be advising a new superintendent who was sort of taking this sort of thing on, I would say you have to figure out how to create the right balance. You don't want to be so beholden to all of the different interest groups that you don't do anything if people don't like it, because change is hard and you're going to get some opposition somewhere. But at the same time, building the coalitions and the constituencies of people who do support your efforts in a careful way, so that there can be a balance out there in terms of how these things are being perceived, is incredibly important. Now, we tried to do a lot of community outreach, and, you know, I'd venture to guess that I was out in the community more than any other super. I mean, I was doing living room meetings and chancellors' town halls and this, that, and the other thing. None of it worked in creating the right community dynamic that we wanted to. And I think it would be very easy for me to say, oh, well, we tried, and so it's not possible. I think that's exactly the wrong tack to take. We tried really hard. We did a lot of things. It didn't work. That doesn't mean that somebody else couldn't do it. and figure it out and do it better. They just, I think, would have to learn from what we did, look at what we did, why maybe some of those things, despite the efforts and the resources, et cetera, didn't result in the desired outcome, and then figure out a course for how, what you know, to figure out what they were going to do that could learn from those lessons.
Thank you. I'd like to give the audience a chance to make comments and ask questions. The way we'll do this is you'll raise your hand. I will call on you. Please ask a question or make a comment to which an answer can be given. If you're giving us a speech, I'll have to cut you off. So we'll have a gentleman in the front row here.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hold on a second. Get your let us know who you are and stand up, please.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. My name is Scott Thomas. I'm with Magnet Schools of America, so you know where this question is coming from. You had mentioned segregation and the correlation with school district performance. I'm curious, Ms. Ree, where you think magnet schools play a role in overall district reform, but also addressing the issues of segregation, which is actually becoming worse, and we know that there are certain factors that contribute to that.
So one of the things that I learned in D.C. was that if you, I would talk to parents a lot from all corners of the city. And one of the things that I heard very, very clearly was that every parent that I ever talked to in Washington, D.C. wanted their kid ideally to be in a diverse environment. The white folks up in Ward 3 wanted their kids to be in a diverse school. The Black parents in Ward 8 also wanted their kids to be in it. That is something I think in general that parents think is a positive thing for their kids. Like, you learn sort of life skills, life lessons, and have experiences with a diversity of people. That's important just as we're raising our kids. How do you create that kind of environment in a district like D.C., which is also incredibly segregated? We weren't able to crack that nut open. But we're thinking about that in a lot of ways, and magnet schools are certainly, if the policies around admission, et cetera, are right, are one way to create that kind of environment. The problem that I find is that whether it's with magnet schools or a few high-performing schools in one, you know, area of town, when the spots in those kinds of schools are so limited, that you've got a dynamic where, you know, thousands of people are applying and only a handful of people get accepted, that is incredibly disheartening to the community. You have to create an environment somehow within the district writ large where every family has high-quality options. It's not just, you know, the bingo ball that's going to determine whether or not your kid gets a good education. You know that whether you can send your kid to the neighborhood school or whether you send your kid to the school 2 miles down the street, they're going to get a good education. And the decision that you're making is not, am I going to send my kid to a crappy school or am I going to move or go to a charter? But the decisions that you're making are, well, my neighborhood school, elementary school teaches French and the school down the block teaches Chinese. I'd rather have my kid teach, learn Chinese. Those are the kinds of decisions our parents should be making, not sort of the life-altering high-quality versus not high-quality ones.
Woman with the kind of purple jacket here on the aisle. Again, wait for the microphone
That's
to come.
That's magenta. Please.
Magenta,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I said kind of purple.
My name is Barbara Stout. I'm a retired community college professor. I now do as much volunteer work as I can. My question, however, is about poverty. None of you has said anything about the effects of poverty on schooling, and it's pretty obvious everywhere that if a public school is in an affluent neighborhood, it's going to range from being good to excellent. If it's in a poor neighborhood, there are many more questions to be dealt with. Please say whatever you can about centers of poverty, schools where all the children are poor.
Yeah. So I'm going to take this from two different angles. Because one sort of stream that's happening in the kind of discussions about education reform these days is people say, well, this is not a problem with the public schools in America. This is a problem with our inner city poor communities. And let me assure you that that is actually not the case. So while we may have schools in our upper income communities that people feel are safe and, you know, et cetera, one of the statistics that I think is most interesting is that if you look at the top quartile of American kids by income in America, so the richest quarter of kids, and you compare them internationally to the richest quarter of kids in every other country, our children rank 23rd out of 30 developed nations. The poorest fourth of our kids, compared to the poorest fourth of other nations' kids, also rank 23rd. So we have not just a problem with our poor kids, we have a problem with our not poor kids too. And the reality is that while our rich kids in this country may be doing better than the poor kids in this country, they're not doing better against their peers in other nations. And that's who they're going to be competing against for jobs when they grow up, not with the kids down the street. So that's one thing. The second thing I'd say is, does poverty matter? Absolutely. When you are a child who lives in abject poverty and you are coming to school every day without being fed a healthy breakfast, without being put to bed the night before at a decent hour, maybe the electricity in your house got shut off, you have a cavity in your tooth the size of a penny. I mean, these things matter. It makes it harder for kids to come to school and learn every day. It makes it harder for the teachers to teach. There's no question about that. However, what the disturbing trend is right now is that now people are saying, well, because of poverty, kids can't learn. So when kids come from poverty, we can't possibly expect the schools and the teachers to do anything about it because look at their parents and look at the environment they come from. And I would say that contention is absolutely wrong. Because if you look at any circumstance across civilization in any country, what we know is that the best tool that we have to fight intergenerational poverty and break that cycle of poverty is education. It's not a particular social program or this or that. It is making sure that that kid gets a high-quality education. So for poor kids in this country, we should not be saying, oh, because you're poor, we can't be expected to provide you with a high-quality education. Instead, what we should be saying is, because you're poor, it is more incumbent upon us to make sure that you get a high-quality education, because that's going to ensure that you're not poor going forward. And I think that this notion, I mean, so if you look at social mobility rates in this country, they are actually near the bottom internationally, which means that if you are a child born into poverty in this country, the likelihood that you will ever escape poverty is not good. That, to me, goes against every ideal we have as a country. That is so un-American, right? This is the country where it doesn't matter where you were born, what your color your skin is, that if you work hard and you do the right thing, you can live the American dream. But that's not the reality for most of the kids in this country today, because if you grow up in this country today in poverty, the likelihood is very great that you go to a failing school where you're not going to learn the skills and knowledge that you need to be a productive member of society. That means that the whole premise on which this country is founded is broken. And in my opinion, the best bet that we have to fix it is through education.
I'm going to weigh in on that, since you said neither of you has said anything about poverty. Actually, if you look at our pie chart, you'll see that it tells a story about how background factors are the biggest piece of the pie. But they don't have to be, and I think that's what Michelle is saying. So we have existence proofs. They're in our data at the district level and further down at the building and the teacher level, where children from backgrounds that would statistically predict the worst possible outcomes are, in fact, achieving at high levels. So we need to acknowledge poverty. We need to acknowledge the effects of communities and social factors. They're all important. But we can't let the schooling system off the hook because we have existence proofs. We have now shown that it can be done, and we need to get along with the job of doing it. Gentleman in the very back on the aisle. You'll find out if you come to these events, if you're on the aisle, you get a slight selection preference when I'm...
Jim Snyder, a former school board member. You mentioned the difficulty of getting the community to buy into your agenda. I'm wondering to what extent is parental intimidation a factor in getting buy-in on some of these difficult problems? So I'll give you a motivating example. You're a parent of an elementary school student, say, in the third grade, and there's two fourth-grade teachers, one the proverbial good teacher and one a proverbial bad teacher, and you join the PTA, and what do you do? Do you try to get rid of the bad teacher and improve the good teacher? No.
Yeah.
you flatter the principal and the powers that be, and you perpetuate the corrupt, and you try to, even though normally the principal is not supposed to play favorites, everybody knows that if you help out, you'll get your kid.
Right.
It's a very corrupt system. And maybe a slightly more specific way to ask the question is the PTAs are supposed to be advocates for the kids, but I happen to think they're among the most corrupt institutions now in America, local PTAs, because they don't do anything to actually help the kids in this most meaningful way, which you've articulated. They just, you know, the parents try to cultivate these relationships at the expense of other kids, basically. And so is there a solution to this problem? And is this a significant problem in your...
So I would say the parental dynamics are important. Let me tell you why. So I got an email about a year ago from a parent who was extraordinarily frustrated. And he said, look, I'm with you. You know, these policies that you're talking about, particularly last in, first out, which was one of our national policies. And he said, let me tell you a story. He said, my kid, third grader, I will admit that my kid is a handful. He is a tough kid to handle. He's had a really difficult schooling experience. He said this year he had an unbelievable teacher. This woman was just a shining star. And my kid now loves going to school every day and is having a great experience. He said, this lady just got a pink slip yesterday. And everybody in the school, it doesn't matter if you ask the janitor, the other teachers, the kids, everybody would tell you that this is one of the best teachers, if not the best teacher in the school. She's getting a pink slip. There's a teacher down the hall who's been here for 15 years. As parents, we all try to navigate our kids around that teacher because we know she's not any good. Why does that teacher get to stay and one of the best teachers is going? So I said to him, so what are you going to do about it? Right? He's like, well, so first I'm going to go and argue to the principal and see if I can get my kid put in the other class. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, we could apply for the charter school, or I guess we could move to this other school district. And so all of his solutions were really localized to his particular kid, right? And what I was trying to convince him of was, if you would spend the same amount of time that you're going to spend researching the other schools and neighborhoods and all this sort of stuff and going to the principal and arguing with them, to mobilize the parents in your school to put some pressure on the legislature to change the last in, first out law, you would not just fix the situation for your kid for this year. You would fix the situation for every kid across the state forever. With the same amount, but that's not how our parents are wired right now to be thinking about how they can be engaged in advocacy efforts. They can get the sort of laws passed, right? It's just, how am I going to solve the problem for my kid? And even then, I mean, so when I was in D.C. and we put in place the last in, first out policy, and the new teacher evaluation system, I had a parent come up to me who said, you know what, I just wanted you to know, I am on board. I mean, I go to a pretty high-performing school. We're happy in general. But there are three teachers in the school that are not good, and you got rid of one of them through the layoffs of low-performing teachers. If the other two can leave, you know, because they're not evaluated well, then we are going to be in really good shape. So we are with you. And I said, great. We actually would love for you as a parent to speak out in favor of this, maybe write a blog. And she's like, oh, no. She's like, if the teachers in the school knew that I was taking an activist role, they might take it out on my kids. I would, you know, I can't do that. But just know that I'm praying for you at night, right? And I think that's where part of the rub comes in for parents. The parents have to be engaged in this. They have to be holding the public officials and other folks accountable for what kinds of policies they have in place for their kids. But their first and most immediate and obvious interest is with their own kid. And if they think by being involved in those activities it is going to be a detriment to their kids, then it's a disincentive, 100%.
You know, in most... other areas of life, there would be some way to tap into that information. You know, parents talk about it in the grocery store. They know who the bad teachers are. Did you ever think about putting a parental satisfaction survey in place in the D.C. schools as a way of systematizing that information and making it available?
So we did, but only at a certain level. It was only at sort of a broad level. We didn't get to the level of, you know, sort of teachers, et cetera. But one of the most interesting things that I think the data points that has come out recently in research shows that there's that one of the things that we should be thinking about adding into teacher evaluations is student and parent feedback about that teacher. In fact, the research shows that student feedback on teachers correlates more highly to teacher performance than principal observations do, because the kids actually see them every day. So if we're able to get kids and parents to be able to weigh in on, you know, how are things in the classroom going, how is the school working overall, I think that could be a potentially very powerful tool.
Here you go.
I'm Roberta Stanley. I'm with the National School Boards Association. I'm really pleased that you addressed special education. An important aspect of special education, of course, is due process, which I think perhaps the district wasn't well served by the way it conducted it in the past. I understand steps were made to improve the special ed hearing process. Yes. Would you address that, please?
Sure. So we had fallen into what could be described as nothing less than absolute dysfunction in this city as it pertained to special education and all of the processes that sort of went along with it, because, one, the school district was just doing a bad job. So for the most part, we were not providing children with the resources and the support that were outlined in their IEPs, and therefore then parents would sue. And there would be this huge, long process. And what was going on was that the process was taking so long and was so cumbersome and so expensive that that in and of itself was costing the district significant resources every year. So what we were trying to do was make an upfront investment in making sure that we could actually handle each of these cases, that when we knew, for example, that the district had done wrong, that we would not continue to allow this to drag out and have ineffective counsel representing us for 3 years while we argued something that we knew we had done wrong. So what we did was, let's settle the case. If we knew we did it wrong, let's settle it quickly, let's figure out what the right remediation is, let's say that and move on. And we found that that was actually a whole lot cheaper and was more satisfying to the family. They didn't want to be involved in a three-year-long court case either, right? So things like that. We did just basic trainings on the people who were going to go represent the district to make sure that they were well equipped to actually, you know, have the conversation, making sure that they were talking to the teacher first to find out what the teacher had actually done or not do, all the documentation, things like that that seem so simple and easy. And the bottom line is that for all of our case managers, we set out very clear metrics and goals for how long each step of the process should take and whether or not you were clearing your cases within that time frame, again, making sure that they had the resources to do so. But it was about putting some accountability into place in a system that had no accountability beforehand. But what I will say is this, that for the most part, what we would have said at the time was that the special education system was 100% broken.
100%?
Yes. It was, I mean, there was nothing that you could look at. Not every person who was working in the system, but the way the bureaucracy worked. And one of the biggest things that we did that helped to sort of turn the tide was, you know, every district was always crying, we're poor, we don't have any money, et cetera, budget cuts, et cetera. What we realized is we needed to invest money at the front end in things. So, for example, we invested money in a program that went out into the community and tested kids from ages 0 to 3 for potential learning disabilities. When you identify the kids that early, there's actually remediation that can take place, therapies, et cetera, that will help the kids so that by the time they come into our system when they're 5 years old, a huge percentage of what the problem was taken care of. So most people would say, well, we don't have the money to invest in the system. But when we looked at the numbers, we knew that the upfront investment in the identification and therapies were actually much more cost effective than what it meant when that kid came in after 5 years having gotten nothing and then putting them through a, you know, 12-year schooling of special education that was much cheaper on the front end and much more effective and, again, more satisfying to the parents to have the problem identified and taken care of on the front end. So it just required a different level of thinking about, even though it didn't look like we had any money, trying to find money for a new program was going to be worth it in the long run.
Did the U.S. Department of Education help you in this process?
I don't think they were hugely involved in that piece of it, no.
Well, this has been very interesting for me. I hope it has been for you. Will you please join me in thanking Michelle for being with us today?
Thank you.